Good morning.
Good morning.
The opening words are from America's new poet laureate, Joy Harjo. She is of Muscogee Creek tribal ancestry, and she is a graduate of Santa Fe's Institute of American Indian Arts. Remember the sky you were born under. Know each of the stars' stories. Remember the moon, know who she is. Remember the sun's birth at dawn, that is the strongest point of time. Remember sundown giving way to night. Remember your birth and how your mother struggled to give you form and breath. You are evidence of her life and her mother's and hers. Remember your father, he is your life also. Remember the earth whose skin you are, red earth, black earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth. We are earth. Remember the plants, trees, animal life, who all have their tribes, their families, their histories. Talk to them, listen to them. They are alive poems. Remember the wind, remember her voice. She knows the origin of the universe. Remember, you are all people, and all people are you. Remember, you are this universe, and this universe is you. Remember, all is in motion, is growing, is you. Remember, language comes from this. Remember, the dance language is that life is. Remember. Here's a poem titled Snake. A snake came to my water trough on a hot, hot day, and I in my pajamas to drink there in the deep, strange scented shade of the great carob tree. It came down the steps, I with my pitcher, and there I must wait, stand and wait, for he was there at the trough before me. He reached down from a fissure in the earth wall in the gloom and trailed his yellow-brown slackness soft-bellied down over the edge of the stone trough and rested his throat on the stone bottom. And where the water had dripped from the tap in a small clearness, he sipped with his straight mouth, softly drank through his straight gums into his long, slack body silently. Someone was before me at my water trough, and I, like a second comer, waiting. He lifted his head from his drinking, as cattle do, and looked at me vaguely, as cattle do, and flickered his two-forked tongue from his lips and mused a moment and stooped and drank a little more, being earth brown, golden brown from the burning bowels of the earth on the day of Sicilian July with Etna smoking. The voice of my education said to me he must be killed, for in Sicily the black snakes are innocent and the gold are venomous. And the voice in me said, if you were a man, you'd take a stick, break him now, finish him off. But must I confess how I liked him, how glad I was he'd come like a guest in quiet to drink at my water trough and depart peaceful, pacified, and thankless into the burning bowels of the earth. Was it cowardice that I dared not kill him? Was it perversity that I longed to talk to him? Was it humility to feel so honored. I felt so honored. And yet those voices, if you were not afraid, you would kill him. And truly, I was afraid. I was most afraid. And even so, honored still more that he should seek my hospitality from out of the dark door of the secret earth. He drank enough and lifted his head dreamily as one who is drunken and flickered his tongue like a forked knight on the air so black, seeming to lick his lips, and looked round like a god and seeing into the air, and slowly turned his head, and slowly, very slowly, as if thrice a dream, proceeded to draw his slow length, curving round and climb again into the broken bank of my wall face. And as he put his head into that dreadful hole, and as he slowly drew up, snake easing his shoulders and entered farther, a sort of horror, a sort of protest against his withdrawing into that horrid black hole, deliberately going into the blackness and slowly drawing himself after, overcame me. Now his back was turned. I looked around. I put down my pitcher. I picked up a clumsy log and threw it at the water trough with a clatter. I think it did not hit him. But suddenly that part of him that was left behind convulsed in an undignified haste, writhed like lightning, and was gone into the black hole, the earth-lipped fissure of the wall front, at which in the intense still noon I stared with fascination, and immediately I regretted it. I thought, how paltry, how vulgar, what a mean act. I despised myself and the voices of my accursed human education. And I thought of the albatross. I wished he would come back, my snake, for he seemed to me again like a king in exile, uncrowned in the underworld, now due to be crowned again. And so I missed my chance with one of the lords of life. And I have something to expiate, a pettiness. These words for our meditation are from Joseph Campbell. We have not even to risk the adventure alone, for the heroes of all time have gone before us. The labyrinth is thoroughly known. We have only to follow the thread of the hero path, and where we had thought to find an abomination, we shall find a god. And where we had thought to slay another, we shall slay ourselves. And where we had thought to travel outwards, we shall come to the center of our own existence. And where we had thought to be alone, we shall be with all the world. This week. Energy fields have been proven to be in and around the physical body. Has any link been studied about the human physical energy field and the spiritual field of mystics and intuitives? Are humans superior to all other animals when it comes to vivisection? The chimpanzees from Alamogordo have all been released, I think, but many of them had been caged for over 35 years. How would you contrast and compare Walt Whitman and D.H. Lawrence as far as the main ideas they were talking about? If scientists do not know or can't identify the margins of consciousness, does it stand to reason or not that everyone's margins overlap when they go beyond their own experiences, sense perceptions, and memories into the realm of ideas? Is there a commonwealth field of consciousness, a cosmic consciousness, that we can all plow, till, and harvest if we expand the margins of our own minds? Finally, would you take the red pill or the blue pill? And how did Trinity's kiss bring back Neo from the dead? So that last was my own question. It refers to the movie The Matrix. Yep. Some of you have seen it. Who has seen The Matrix? Many. If you have not seen this film, it depicts a dystopian future where human beings have all been plugged into an artificially intelligent network that keeps them in a state of permanent suspended animation or hibernating inside mechanical cocoons, where all of the electromagnetic power from their brains and spinal cords is sucked from their bodies to generate a shared virtual reality inside their heads, inducing them all to have a common dream that they are living in New York City in the 1990s, which is when the movie was made, rather than awakening to the awful truth that they are just napping batteries. They are energizer bunnies snoozing inside a somnambulistic nightmare. You take the blue pill and you remain in a pleasant dreamland. You take the red pill and you learn just how deep the rabbit hole goes. And naturally, being Unitarians, we will take the red pill. Just as the hero, Neo, did. One reason this film was so popular, one reason that it works, is that it's based on familiar archetypes. It's a mix of Plato's cave, Sleeping Beauty, and the Apostle Paul. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face, now we know only in part, then we will know fully, even as we have been fully known. Love, says Paul, is the secret ingredient inside the red pill that frees us from the illusion of our separateness, that frees us from mortality and death, and liberates us into a full understanding of our true identity, who we are, members of one timeless body. The body of Krishna, or Christ, or Trinity, or Kuan Yin, or whatever name it is you give to ultimate reality. Archetypes, fairy tales, myths, these are part of what make movies like The Matrix work. They're what make poetic symbols and metaphors like D.H. Lawrence's snake, a king uncrowned in the underworld, what make them so powerful and evocative. They come from the unconscious mind where dreams live, and scholars of religion like Joseph Campbell would say that these are universals. They are part of every woman and every man who is the hero with a thousand faces, whose destiny is to disembark from the safety of the womb, to leave behind the innocence and enchantment of childhood, and struggle with the ordeals and dragons of adult life, and finally to gain the golden prize of wisdom. Of course, the big problem with the Matrix is that it's fantasy, fortunately. It's not science. The human brain actually generates about the same amount of power as a 10-watt light bulb. Not this much, the kind in your refrigerator. So it doesn't really make that much sense practically to plug us all into a great power grid. But what a lot we manage with those skimpy 10 watts. Recently I started resubscribing to Scientific American. According to my latest issue, the brain consists of about 100 billion neurons with 100 trillion interconnections or synapses. That's a big, big number. If you started counting 1, 2, 3, 4, to reach 100 trillion would take you just over 31,000 years. In an article titled How Matter Becomes Mind, the authors there in Scientific American, they tried to explain the origins of consciousness by mapping this vast complexity into a computer simulation of 300 node points. In other words, they have no clue how we become self-aware. But we do know that the brain is constantly pulsing with alpha waves, with beta, with theta, with delta waves. Some are associated with deep sleep, some with dreaming, some with problem solving, some with more relaxed, contemplative types of moods. They're vibrating at frequencies from 0.5 to 30 hertz or cycles per second. And even when we're in high beta mode, even then, part of our brain is dreaming, and vice versa, which could explain phenomena like the famous case of the German chemist, Kekulé, over a century ago, who was searching for the structure of the benzene molecule. He couldn't figure it out. He went to sleep and he had a dream. His dream was of a snake eating its own tail. You talk about an archetype. And he woke up in the morning and he realized that the benzene molecule, the carbon atoms, had to be arranged in a ring or a circular structure. So his brain was processing information even when he was sleeping. And for reasons like this, I put some stock, some credit in dreams. I have this recurring dream where I'm in a house that seems very familiar. It is my own house, even though it's not an actual house. It's not the address where I presently live. Now, I think that every part of every dream represents some part of yourself, because you're the one doing the dreaming. You're the one generating these delta waves, this REM sleep. So it's part of you, even if it's just the bad Chinese food you have for dinner. But many people would say that symbols and images like a house or a home almost always represent oneself. They represent the structure of the psyche. And in this particular house, in my dream, the house all seems familiar, but off in the back or down a hall or to the side off the kitchen, there's a whole other suite of rooms that I hardly ever go to, that are mostly vacant, that are not quite creepy, but that are somewhat off limits. They're just sort of unexplored. And I take this to represent my shadow or aspects of my own personality that I don't really want to visit. And in another variation on this dream, I enter into a house that seems kind of small on the outside, but then when I open the door and I go in, it's quite spacious, almost palatial on the interior. So I'm going to take a show of hands here. Have any of you ever had dreams like this where you're in a house and it seems to have hidden rooms or secret chambers or unknown annexes? A lot of hands go up. You know, Jesus said, "In my Father's house, there are many rooms." Walt Whitman said, "I contain multitudes." D.H. Lawrence put it this way: "This is what I believe, that I am I, that my known self will never be more than a little clearing in the forest, that gods, strange gods, come forth from the forest into the clearing of my known self and then go back, and that I must have the courage to let them come and go." And he also spoke of religion as being a continuous process of conversion, not of being born again in an evangelical sense, but of being born over and over. "I believe one is born first," he said, "to one's own self, for the happy developing of oneself, while the world's a nursery and the pretty things are to be snatched and the pleasant things tasted, and some people seem to exist thus right to the very end, but most are born again on entering adulthood, and then they are born to humanity, to a consciousness of all the laughing, never-ceasing murmur of pain and sorrow that comes from the terrible multitude of sisters and brothers. And then it appears to me a person gradually formulates his or her religion, be it what it may. An individual has no religion who has not slowly, painfully gathered one together, adding to it, shaping it. And one's religion is never final or complete, it seems to me, but must always be undergoing modification. A religion so acquired, I think, is the goal of the hero's journey, the alchemical transmutation of lead into gold and sorrow into enlightenment, which is a kind of heightened realization. When an MRI scans the brains of Buddhist monks who have spent thousands or tens of thousands of hours sitting on a cushion, a special part of the cerebrum lights up, the anterior insula. It's vibrating, oscillating gamma radiation at a high frequency. And these monks have devoted their entire lifetimes to meditating on what they call the noble truths, the first noble truth, that life is suffering. All life is suffering. And the truth that the root of suffering is ego, craving, attachment. And finally, that the end of suffering, liberation, nirvana, whatever you want to call it, is found through the cultivation of empathy and generosity and compassion for others. So instead of focusing their energy on me, 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 on winning, achieving, on self-aggrandizement, they are deliberately centering their attention with each breath in every moment on the well-being of all creation. And this is the doorway to what might be called the ecological self, to a realization of who we are, our interdependence, our mutuality with every living creature. Because if the mind has a subconscious, if it's got a basement level, why shouldn't it also have a superconscious and an upper story? But the path to that upper story often leads through pain. Jane Goodall spoke of both the agony and the ecstasy in her autobiography, Reason for Hope, where she talks about the death of her husband, Derek Bryson, whose diagnosis with colon cancer marked a descent into depression and soul searching for the famous primatologist. In spite of her prayers, the doctors found her husband's condition was inoperable. They gave him just weeks to live, weeks that were filled with anguish and bodily torment, the gradual increase of pain, the injections at night instead of pills. She recalls the horror of it, suffering, for the suffering of one I loved more deeply with each passing day. Jane looked everywhere for help, to Western medicine, to faith healers, to psychics. None of it slowed the disease, and Derek's death brought her to an abyss of doubt and despair. And for a while after Derek's death, she said, "I rejected God, and the world seemed a bleak place." And it was a couple of years later, she explained, that hope re-entered her universe. She was exhausted after a lecture tour in the United States. She'd returned to the Gombe Stream Reserve to be with her other family, with her beloved chimps. Climbing up the hilly terrain, she found herself caught together with them in a drenching rainstorm, and then basking in the soft glow of sunlight afterward. It's hard, impossible really, to put into words the moment of truth that came upon me then, she says. It seemed to me, as I struggled to recall the experience after, that self was utterly absent. I and the chimpanzees and the earth and the trees and the air all seemed to merge, to become one with the spirit power of life itself. The air was filled with a feathered symphony, the even song of birds. I heard new frequencies in their music and in the insects' voices, notes so high and intense I was amazed. Every vein in every leaf seemed individual and unique. Time slowed. Jane said at that order she felt she was part of a natural order that dwarfs and yet somehow enhances human emotions. The forest gave her, she said, the peace that passes understanding. She was changed, you could say, converted by that experience. She no longer spends her time doing field work or research in chimpanzees. Instead, she battles for getting chimps and other primates out of the laboratory, which is needed work, not just for our closest cousins, but for the millions of other dogs and pigs and goats and rodents and other sentient beings who suffer annually, because animal research is science. Occasionally, perhaps it's good science, but it's not just science. It's also big business. It's funded by big pharma. It's funded by big agriculture. Think Monsanto. Think Cargill. It's funded by the Department of Defense. That's who kept those Alamogordo chimps in captivity. It's funded by other organizations that do not want you to know about goats genetically modified so that they have been combined with the DNA of spiders, who don't want you to know about phosphorescent sheep or dolphins trained for underwater mine warfare, because it is not in their interest for you to know these things. Trust us, they say. It's hard for me to trust. Years ago, Dory and I wanted to find out how our tax dollars were being spent at our State University of Vermont. And we went to attend a meeting of the IACUC, the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, which oversees animal research on campus. Every university has one. IACUCs were created and mandated under the Federal Animal Welfare Act, and they're supposed to contain at least one member of the public who doesn't have any connection with a testing facility to make sure that the experimental protocols and care all meet the highest ethical and veterinary standards. We were ordinary citizens, curious for information about what was happening there, and we were immediately asked to leave the room, expelled by the committee, made to sit in the hall like naughty children, while the IACUC went into executive session for the entirety of its meeting with no notes or minutes of its proceedings. Were they making two-headed monkeys in their labs? I have no idea. We don't know. All we know is that they were making monkeys out of us. They were transgressing the university's commitment to free inquiry and accountability. They were trampling on the open exchange of information and ideas. I expect that our experience was not unusual. It is now a felony to go inside an animal lab or inside a factory farm and take unauthorized recordings or photographs under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Now, this is not a simple misdemeanor. It's not an act of trespass or unlawful entry or even malicious mischief, and it's certainly not considered an act of whistleblowing or good investigational journalism to call out unethical or unsafe or unsanitary conditions. No, it's a crime of terrorism, punishable by 20 years in a federal penitentiary, thanks to a statute written and endorsed by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And if you have never heard of ALEC, you'd better call the Oracle. And you'd better run for the nearest phone booth, because they're as close as it comes to the agents who own and operate the Matrix. So, having answered your questions, or some of them, I want to leave you with some provocative questions. Are you comfortable just thinking your meat comes from the grocery store, or would you like the law to allow you to know the truth about animal industrial agriculture? Do you want to know how the CIA used animal experiments to perfect interrogation and torture techniques at its black sites used on humans? Or would you just like the intelligence community to be trusted on that? In other words, do you want to take the blue pill or the red pill?